Hello, and welcome to GradCast, the official radio show and podcast of the Society of Graduate Students at Western University. I'm one of your hosts, Liam Clifford.
And I'm your other host, Carly Sharon.
And today we have Lauren Rago, a second-year master's student with the Department of Biology here today. Lauren, how are you today?
I'm good, thanks. Thank you so much for having me.
This is not a problem, Carly. It's also lovely to see you. I believe this is our first interview together,
yes,
so
it is,
I'm looking forward to that. So, Lauren, we're going to start you off with a really difficult question of what brings you to Western?
Oh, wow. It's a good one. Well, I did my undergrad at Western, and I chose Western just because I felt like it was a really good fit for me. I liked that it was a bigger school, but it still had a really cool biology program because I've always known that I really liked biology. And yeah, when I toured Western when I was in my last year of high school, I really loved it. So I came here, spent my whole undergrad here. I had a little bit of time kind of taken away from COVID. So I felt like when I was getting to the end of my fourth year, I wasn't quite done with London yet. Mm-hmm. And so then I just started exploring grad school options here. And then that's when I kind of stumbled on what I'm doing now.
Yeah, that's fantastic. It's great to hear people passionate about graduate school. Part of the reason why we're here today. So with that icebreaker in mind, Lauren, why don't you introduce the folks to your topic today?
Yeah, so the focus of my topic, I research, I'm kind of in the stream of physiology and biochemistry in the Department of Biology at Western, and my research focuses on 13-lined ground squirrels, which are little hibernating rodents, and I focus on how they're able to kind of suppress their mitochondrial respiration when they hibernate, which is obviously a lot of science jargon for people who may not be so familiar. Basically, when the squirrels hibernate, they're able to kind of take their mitochondrial respiration, their breathing, their heart rate, everything really, really low, and then they stay low for a few weeks. They'll have these kind of spurts where they come back up to normal temperatures, normal respiration rates. And it's really cool because they don't really incur any damage over this transition phase. And they also are able to just kind of suppress really heavily all of their respiration, their heart rate, and everything. So I kind of look at mechanisms in the mitochondria that might be responsible for the downregulation of all these different systems.
Very interesting. My God, I wish I could suppress my own heart rate sometimes in graduate school.
Oh my gosh,
that would be what a skill that would be. That's for sure. So appreciate that insight.
I have a very technical question. Mm-hmm. Why is it called the 13-line ground squirrel?
They have 13 lines on their back.
Okay.
Yeah, very simple.
Interesting.
Yeah, little. They're very stripy. I mean, for anyone looking or listening, you should look them up. They're very cute. They kind of look more like a chipmunk than a squirrel, but they have 13 lines on their back instead of the like five that chipmunks do.
And why study this specific squirrel? Like, do they...
They hibernate, and they're obligate hibernators. So an obligate hibernator is a hibernator that's going to hibernate regardless of the temperature and the light conditions outside. So even if we're not in a winter climate, they are going to hibernate if it's hot out, if it's cold out, regardless, they're going to hibernate. There are other hibernators who are facultative, which means that they'll hibernate just on like a necessity basis. But these 13-line ground squirrels are easy to research because for us, they're pretty, well, relatively easy to access. They breed very readily. And yeah, they're just a really great model for looking at hibernation because they have these bouts where they hibernate for a few weeks and then they have these interbout arousals where they come back up to their normal euthermic levels of like heart rate, respiration, mitochondrial respiration, and then they go back down. So they do this kind of cyclic thing all winter long. And so it's really an interesting model for us to study. And they also just don't really incur much cellular damage over that time. Okay. So it's a very cool thing to look at.
Neat.
Very interesting. I you know, part of me is going to the number 13. I'm wondering if people down the line were always thinking that these are superstitious squirrels or anything of that nature. But this is really interesting because this is so far and above what I study. Mm-hmm. You know, like the extent of my biology knowledge would be probably secondary school. So when I saw the word mitochondria and I recognized that, I was absolutely buzzing. So we talked about the specific type of squirrel, but why squirrels themselves? I know you sort of explained a little bit about that. How would this compare to another, I guess, comparable mammal, ones that hibernate?
Well, most mammals that hibernate are small, are very small. Like, I know a lot of people, when you think of hibernation, your mind goes to a bear, but bears are like actually the weirdest case of hibernation. They're so large and their body temperature doesn't drop as severely as our little ground squirrels will, just because they have so much mass that it would be really kind of hard for them to bring all that mass back down and up all those times throughout the winter. The ground squirrels are easy to study just because we know that they're going to hibernate regardless of what conditions they're in. I mean, albeit we do keep them in conditions that mimic their natural habitats. But yeah, they're always going to hibernate. They're an easy model to study. They kind of are similar in a way, if you think about it, to like a lab rat or something. You know, they have very similar physiology to one of those animals. And so we can also use them as a, we can use something like a rat as a comparison group for our squirrels. So yeah, they're a really great animal to study just because of their ability to hibernate so well and mm-hmm. so consistently. And so because of that, their mitochondria are super cool to look at just because they're very consistent and, like, you know, yeah.
Yeah, no, I find that really interesting. This notion of hibernation and how it works. So I'm curious now to speak about the physiological symptoms that these squirrels experience when they undergo this process of slowing their heart rate down and slowing other bodily functions. Could you explain how that works within the squirrel's body?
Yeah, so basically when we're at a normal level, we call that euthermia. So if you hear me say the word euthermia, that just basically means you're at your normal state where your body temperature is at, for a mammal, 37 degrees Celsius, and for our squirrels. And their heart rate is really high. It's about 350 beats per minute. Their respiration, so their ventilation, is really normal. So their breathing is normal, very quick. And they're warm, you know, they're moving around, they're eating, they're not using the washroom, they're going to the bathroom. And yeah, so like they're normally at those levels. And then when the hibernation season starts, which is typically around like end of October, beginning of November, they'll start doing this thing that we call torpor. And torpor, I don't know if you've ever heard a podcast where Emily talks about torpor in hummingbirds, but torpor in these mammals is characterized by them dropping their body temperature from about 37 degrees Celsius to about 4 degrees Celsius, wow. which is a really, wow. really severe drop. So they drop their body temperature that low. Their respiration rate goes down a lot as well. They're like they have only a couple breaths every minute. And their heart rate goes very, very low as well. And so when they're hibernating, essentially, if you were to pick up a hibernating squirrel and look at it, they're freezing cold and they curl up in these tiny little balls and they burrow in their little nests. And they'll stay in this torpid state for about 2 weeks before they come back up. And so when I say come back up, instead of saying wake up, because as a hibernation physiologist, that is a no-go. That is not correct. But when they have these arousals, so they're exiting torpor and they're coming back up into an arousal, basically what they're going to be doing is just rewarming their body temperature right back up to 37 degrees Celsius. They're going to bring their ventilation right back up to their normal breathing. They're going to bring their heart rate up to normal rates. And this will last for probably about 8 to 12 hours, depending on the animal. And then they'll just drop back down into torpor once that's done. And they do this cyclical thing all winter long.
Okay, and what's the reason, like, for the cycles? Like, do all animals that hibernate? Like, I mean, I have very limited knowledge on hibernation, but yeah. I thought it was just, like, they stay hibernating through the winter.
Honestly, before I started researching hibernators, I definitely thought the exact same thing. Mm-hmm. I had honestly no idea how hibernation worked until I really started researching it, and it's been so cool. But, yeah, basically, other animals who hibernate can do similar things. There are a lot of other obligate hibernators, but there are also a lot of facultative hibernators. So for example, there are other species of ground squirrels that will hibernate just on like a necessity basis. Mm-hmm. So say they live in a population where it gets really cold and it's going to be a little like winter conditions outside, then they might drop their body temperature down and they might exhibit torpor. However, they'll only do it on like a necessity basis. Okay. So if they're in an environment where it's hot, they'll stay at those normal euthermic levels and they won't go into a hibernation state. Whereas our hibernators are obligate hibernators, so they're going to do it regardless of what else is going on. But yeah, so other animals, all hibernation is a little bit different for each different species. But yeah.
And in that like 8 to 12 hours that you said they are aroused, so you said, do they like go get a snack? Like, what do they do during that time?
Well, they actually don't eat and they don't really consume water either while they're in their hibernation state. And they do not go to the bathroom either. So they kind of are just up. They're moving around. And that's another reason why it's really interesting to be able to study these hibernators, mm-hmm. because we know they arouse, but it's not to eat. It's not to go to the bathroom and it's not to have water. So we're like, okay, why are they doing this? And a big kind of conclusion you can draw from that is that they're having these arousals to prevent damage to their cells over the course of hibernation. Because if you think about it, coming up from a hibernation, like a torpor bout, is kind of similar to an ischemia reperfusion event, which would be something like a heart attack or a stroke in like a human, if we were to think about just like our regular healthcare lives. And so if you were to come back from one of those events where you have really low blood flow and then you go to really high blood flow, an event like that will often cause a lot of damage to your cells just because you have that huge influx of oxygen that you weren't experiencing before. Mm-hmm. And so in humans, we would get a lot of cell damage if we were to do something like that. But for example, our ground squirrels, they aren't experiencing much damage at all. By the time they reach that inner bout euthermia arousal and by the time they're at the end of the hibernation season, they don't have damage to their cells. They aren't like injured. They're not, you know, at any loss for their physical abilities. And so it's a really interesting model to be able to characterize maybe how they're doing the, like, what the actual purpose of these arousals are. Mm-hmm.
Hmm. That's really interesting. So do these squirrels naturally, I guess for lack of a better term, bulk up before they go into hibernation?
Yes.
So that they have these, I guess, bodily reserves that they can replenish themselves with?
Yeah, they definitely are very chubby before the hibernation season right. starts. I think we'll have some that will, like, over the hibernation season, lose nearly like 100-150 grams over the entire season.
Wow.
So when they come out of hibernation, which was actually just a couple weeks ago that we moved them back to their spring-summer facilities, they're quite small, but then again, they bulk up quite quickly once again. So mm-hmm. it's not like they're getting like morbidly obese before the hibernation season starts, but they definitely are a little bit chubbier. They are putting on all that mass so that they're able to sustain this hibernation season. And it's interesting because what you can notice is, like, obviously with hibernation, you are going to have some casualties over the course of a hibernation season because it is an event where, you know, you're having a lot of like rewarming, which mm-hmm. could, you know, cause an event like a heart attack or a stroke if they were to experience a blood clot or any adverse health effect kind of during that arousal. So we naturally will lose a few animals over the hibernation season. And it is interesting because you can see that sometimes it's ones that have like lower mass. Those will be the ones that are not going to be as well equipped to mm-hmm. survive a hibernation season.
And tell me this much, what's the average lifespan for this variation of squirrel?
Oh, it really depends.
Okay.
For our purposes, we usually have our squirrels for about one season.
Okay.
But they can live several years. I mean, they're not going to be upwards of 20, but I would say within the maybe, like, depending on the climate that they're living in and their conditions, I would say maybe like 2 to like 6 years-ish.
Okay. That's really interesting. And the squirrels that you folks work with in biology, are they all around the same age, or are they different ages from different stages of their squirrel lives?
We try to keep a pretty diverse population just so that we're not working with kind of a skewed population.
Makes
so we
sense.
Have a large variation in ages. We actually have squirrels that we have, so we capture our own squirrels, which I can get to in a minute.
Okay.
I was going to ask about
that.
Yeah.
So we capture our own squirrels and then we bring them to London. So we can't really track their age. Obviously, there are some measures you can do to see, okay, how does their body condition? Is their fur a little bit? Sometimes they actually go a little bit gray around the nose when they're getting older. But you can kind of estimate their age, and then we'll have them for several seasons, depending on the animal. We'll also breed them, and then we have offspring for several seasons, and those ones we can better track their age.
Okay.
But we do have a really diverse population when we do take mitochondria from these animals, just so we don't have any kind of skewed data.
Makes sense.
Yeah, so tell us more about going out and catching these squirrels.
Oh my, so going out and catching our squirrels, we actually have to catch them because they're not native to London or Ontario for that matter.
Oh, wow.
So we catch ours in the closest point that we can get them, which is in Carman, Manitoba. And
wow.
So we drive a sprinter van to Manitoba, me, my supervisor, and then whichever lab mates are, you know, in the lab at the time or working with ground squirrels at the time. And we go to Manitoba and we trap our squirrels. So we have these little handheld traps where we stick them in the burrows and the squirrels crawl out into these bags and we put them in our little van and we drive them back to London. And
wow.
So because they're non-native, we have to keep them in like facilities indoors in Western and keep them all under lock. But yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, I'm just taking that in because the history department certainly does not go out and trap wildlife.
Yes.
So that's remarkable. How long is it a drive out there? It must be a serious trek.
It is a long drive. Last year I've only gone on it one time because last year we had a very fruitful trapping season, so we don't have to go back this year.
Okay.
But basically last year we tacked it onto a conference trip, so we drove about 26-27 hours to Saskatoon, and then we drove 10 hours or 8 hours from Saskatoon to Carman, Manitoba, and then from Carman, Manitoba, you unfortunately cannot take the shortcut through the States because we have
squirrels
in the van.
Right.
30 squirrels in the van. Can't really bring those across the border very easily. So then we have to go all through Northern Ontario, which takes about 30 hours on the way home.
Oh.
Yeah, it's a long drive to be in a van with 30 squirrels.
Yeah, long drive for animal and human alike.
Mm-hmm.
How are the squirrels kept on board as you're transporting them?
Yeah, so we keep them in the cages that we actually just have them in our facilities here, which are these like basically what you'd see at a pet store, kind of like but a plastic version of it. It's like a little plastic clear cage, and then each cage has one individual animal in it. and we have these little metal lids that just snap on. And so we take all the seats out of the back of a Sprinter van and we lay all these cages down. And wow. we usually fit about 25 or 30 in there.
Oh my gosh.
And then we run around, trap a bunch of squirrels, fill all the cages. And once all the cages are filled, we can start our drive back.
Do they make a lot of noise?
Oh my gosh, so much noise. They do several different noises that are all really jarring and a little bit unsettling if you're not familiar with them. They do really high-pitched squeaks okay. that are like, I can't really describe it. Everyone look up a 13-line ground squirrel screaming. And then they also grunt, and sometimes they, if enough of them are grunting, it almost sounds like they're starting to do it in unison.
Oh my gosh.
And it is really loud, and then they just run around their cages too, and they've got little claws and fling bedding everywhere, so it's really a treat to spend that much time yeah. in a car with them.
It's not
to
terrible.
Mention that they don't smell the best.
Yeah.
Wow, I can't imagine a squirrel grunting at me, let alone a little army of
squirrels
of grunting
them, yeah.
at me.
And they're all not, they're not happy with us, you know. We've just ripped them from their home, so
yeah fair enough. So I'm taking all of this in, and as I've said a couple of times, this is so divergent from what I study, but how would you describe what you're doing to a non-science student?
Ooh, that's a good question. To a non-science student, I would say that I take mitochondria from these squirrels who are able to hibernate in a really cool way, and I isolate the mitochondria, so I'm looking at just the mitochondria. And I will then do experiments on them to see different things that are changing about the mitochondrial protein between hibernation, so torpor, when they're like in that really low suppressed state, between that and then interbout euthermia, which is when they're in their aroused state during hibernation. And then I compare both of those hibernation groups to a summer group. So I take mitochondria from all three groups and I run different experiments on them just so I can see what the mitochondria kind of have bound to them during these different states. So I can kind of maybe make conclusions about if certain things bound to certain parts of the mitochondria are causing suppression of mitochondrial respiration, which I guess I've kind of gone into science-y territory with that one. But yeah.
That's okay. I'll pull you off on the next question. Explain for the uninitiated what a mitochondria is.
Ooh, a mitochondria is the powerhouse of the cell.
There we go. There's school coming back out.
Yes, it's a large producer of ATP in our cells, which is what we need for energy and to fuel a lot of things. And so, yeah, we specifically look at the mitochondria. More specifically, we look at liver mitochondria because the liver is really densely packed with mitochondria. And we know that the liver mitochondria are responsible for a lot of overall respiration for these animals. So, yeah, and their metabolism.
Okay, so you mentioned that you isolate the mitochondria. How do you do that? And then what are you looking for once you have
yes.
the mitochondria?
Good question. So when we isolate mitochondria, we essentially humanely euthanize the animal, and then we remove the liver of the animal, and we immediately place it on really cold buffer that's made out of a bunch of different things that help keep the mitochondria alive during our isolation process. Then we bring it up to our lab. We do a few steps to kind of mince things up, and then we put everything into our centrifuge and we spin it down at a bunch of different speeds for several different spins, and it takes usually about 2-ish hours, maybe 3. And then we end up with a purified mitochondrial pellet. So it's just a pellet of really concentrated mitochondria. And then we resuspend that into a little bit of a buffer. And then I, for my own experiments, freeze them right away. There are other people in the lab who have done other experiments with things called, or with a machine called an oxygraph, where basically you put mitochondria in it and you put substrates in and you just see how the mitochondria behave with all these different substrates added to them. So you can see how they perform respiration and that sort of stuff. But for the purpose of my experiments, I freeze my mitochondria until I have all my appropriate groups collected. And then I do Western blotting. And what I'm doing with my Western blotting is looking at different post-translational modifications to these mitochondrial proteins. So these are modifications that have happened after translation. So there's transcription, translation, then there's post-translational modifications. So I'm looking to see which post-translational modifications of a group of 8 change between torpor, interbout euthermia, and then just normal summer euthermia. So I'm trying to see if they're upregulated, downregulated in any groups, and if I can make any conclusions about if these specific modifications are kind of the driving force or playing a large role in downregulating mitochondrial respiration.
Cool. Okay.
I have sort of a question that might take us a little away from that, but I do think is still related. Is hibernation, is this a developed evolutionary trait that comes in mammals? Like, are we familiar enough with the history of mammals to know that they've always hibernated? Or, you know, is this something that's developed over thousands of years of evolution?
Hibernation is definitely an evolutionary trait. It's definitely, we can see it in a lot of different groups of animals over evolutionary time. A good way to look at it is an animal is going to hibernate out of necessity. And so obviously it's not like we're just going to start hibernating because one day I was really cold and I forgot my coat at home, so I had to start hibernating. Obviously it's something that we evolutionarily came up with and started doing in certain species. However, if you think about different groups of animals, we can kind of trace it back and see if they actually have a need to hibernate. So our squirrels are 13-lined ground squirrels, aka they spend most of their time on the ground. They live in burrows in the ground. So because of that, their terrain that they live in is often things like prairies and plains where there's not a lot of tree coverage, and they live in these burrows below the ground where it gets really cold and it's hard for them to kind of evade the cold. And it's also difficult for them to find food because they're on the ground and the ground is all frost covered and all the food sources are kind of cold, frozen, or non-existent. So for these animals, they have to hibernate because there's no other way for them to survive these harsh winters. But if you think about something like a bird that can migrate away for the summer or right. for the winter and then stay for the summer, they don't really have a need to hibernate. So things like birds wouldn't really have that same need to hibernate. And then you could also think about things like larger mammals that have the capacity to still hunt and to do things over the course of the winter and still have access to their food sources. But for these squirrels specifically, they lose access to all of their food source and the weather just becomes really harsh for them to sustain for the whole winter. So that's kind of why hibernation is so useful for them.
Thank you for that.
So I'm curious, earlier you mentioned that you just moved the squirrels to their spring / summer facility. I'm assuming they then have a winter facility. Yes. And what's the difference between the two?
So our summer facility is basically just like normal rooms in the basement of one of the research buildings at Western. And it's like, they're just very empty, large rooms that we set the temperature and the light conditions. We look on our phones always at the weather conditions once weekly of where we trap them, so Carmen, Manitoba, and then we set the appropriate light conditions and the appropriate temperature just based on that week. And so those rooms are very basic. They're not really anything special. But our winter rooms, we try to keep them at a very similar, like I said, temperature to Carmen, Manitoba. So we put them in these winter rooms that are essentially just large walk-in freezers. And we have these racks of squirrels just sitting in the rooms. And the rooms are very dark for the most part because it's dark in their burrows and mm-hmm. they spend all of the winter in their burrows. So we keep the rooms very dark and very cold. And so, you know, you have to wear a coat when you go in to check on them every day.
Of course.
But yeah, so their winter facility is just essentially a big walk-in freezer where all the conditions are controlled so that it matches what it's like in Manitoba. And then summer facilities are just kind of a big empty room that, again, is matched to the summer facility or the summer weather conditions.
Okay, interesting.
The background of labs and like the hands-on scientific stuff is I think is really important context for people who don't deal with that on a regular basis. So I appreciate the insight there. So I think it's fascinating that you're looking at the squirrels in different stages and recognizing whether or not there are changes in there. What are your hopes for this research?
Ooh, that's a good question. My hopes for this research, well, so far, I mean, I have been finding some significant differences when I look at my groups. Like specifically, I'm looking at 8 different modifications to their mitochondria, and I have found some differences between my 2 hibernation groups. And so what I hope to have with this research is just to see, okay, there is a definitive change in, let's say, phosphorylation or acetylation between torpor and intermittent euthermia. And then from there, it kind of opens up avenues for maybe being able to treat mitochondria with things that could add a phosphorylation group or add an acetylation group. And then we can further see if that is actually working or if that's just kind of an artifact that showed up along the way. So, I mean, I guess for this research, my hope right now would just be further research.
Of course.
To just further explore these questions. I think that it is a long stretch before it reaches the application of going all the way to being able to say, okay, we can now enact this on human mitochondria.
Right.
And we can downregulate their mitochondria when we have a heart attack or a stroke event. But yeah, for now, I just hope that it opens up avenues for more research, looking at further avenues of how mitochondrial respiration is downregulated in hibernation. So I guess kind of right now it's just to further the research.
Of course, and you know, whether or not that amounts to a PhD is nudge nudge, wink wink, is always something I'm sure that will be on the cards. So that sounds very exciting for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm curious, you mentioned like you were a long ways away from applying this to humans, but I was actually going to ask about that, like if this could be applied to humans. So you mentioned like recovery from a heart attack or a stroke. Yeah. How exactly would that work?
Yeah, so if I think that the easiest and the most applicable thing that you could probably look at would be something like an organ transplant,
okay,
where you know that you're going to go from really essentially no blood flow to a ton of blood flow as soon as that new organ is hooked up in a human body. And so you can think about it in the fact that usually those organs will experience some level of damage when mm-hmm. this reperfusion event occurs, when blood starts to flow readily back into the organ. And so if we were able to somehow figure out what mechanism these ground squirrels are using in order to suppress their mitochondrial respiration without experiencing much damage, then that could be something that down the line maybe we could apply to another organism just to see if it would have the same effect. But yeah, like I said, that is very, very far down the road, and that is kind of a stretch for the scope of my research. I mean, I only have a few more months left, so I don't think I'll be starting clinical trials with humans anytime soon.
No, that's really cool, though. I always wonder, like, are we just looking at this because we're curious about the squirrels, or is there some broader application?
Definitely, there are broader things. Mm-hmm. I think for now, it's just to kind of broaden the field of hibernation research.
Yeah, that's really cool.
Thank you for sharing that. A bit of a fun one. Are you familiar? You're obviously familiar with the scientific name of these squirrels.
Oh, Ictodomus tridecimiliatus. I know I always butcher it every single time.
Yeah, no, I was having a look at this and I didn't even want to attempt to say this. So would you clarify that?
Ictodomus tridecimiliatus.
Okay, all right.
I know I butchered the last part every single time.
That was a mouthful, or in other words, the 13 line ground squirrels today. You'll never find me ever trying to pronounce those zoological names ever.
Yeah, it's a tough one.
Yeah, it is a tough one indeed. We are approaching the end, Lauren. It's been wonderful to speak to you. We wanted to ask if you had any social media that you'd like to share with us today.
Yes, I do. I have a Twitter that does not have a huge following, but I would always love to gain new followers and talk to cool people who want to learn more about my research. So my Twitter handle is LaurenRego3, Rego spelled R-E-G-O. And yeah, you can follow me on there and DM me any questions that anyone would have.
Fantastic. Well, you heard it here first. That's LaurenRego3 on Twitter, formerly Twitter, or now
still
X.
Twitter. Yes.
Still Twitter for so many of us who have used it. But Lauren, we just want to say thank you very much for coming on the show. It's been wonderful to speak to you.
It's been great.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
And this has been GradCast, the official radio show and podcast of the Society of Graduate Students at Western University. I've been your host, Liam Clifford, and my cohort was Carly Sharon. We've been speaking with Lauren Rego, and this episode was produced by Amelie Hutchinson. If you'd like to be involved with the show or get in contact with us, email us at gradcastradio@sogs.ca. You can follow us on Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter at gradcastradio. To listen to us, we are on Radio Western 94.9 FM. You can also find all of our episodes wherever you find your podcasts. Thank you for listening, and have yourselves a wonderful rest of the day.